Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks, at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up, the usual two segments. Today, first in a few minutes, a look at Harvard's honoring of Marty Peretz. Martin Peretz is the editor-in-chief of The New Republic, a magazine that he bought with his wife's inherited money back in the 1970s and turned a distinguished old liberal magazine into a it has its moments now, but it also is a forum for Marty Peretz's ranting and raving over his hatreds of the darker people of the world. And we'll discuss an event honoring him at Harvard last week and protests against that and as a window into life among the American elite. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Antonio Ujas, who is directs Global Exchange's oil program and author of books about oil. Got a book coming out next year about the BP spill. And she is being prosecuted by Chevron. Well, or she got the Chevron is getting the state to prosecute her for disrupting their annual meeting. And we'll talk to her about that, about oil, about Chevron, and the BP spill and all kinds of things like that. Not much time today. Got a full plate here, but only a few words in the economic news. Some longer-term observations based on the latest flow of funds accounts from the Federal Reserve, which came out about a week ago. The flow of funds are a financial analog to the more familiar national income accounts, the source of the GDP numbers and such. Though GDP figures don't have much to say about financial flows, they're more real sector than that, as they say on Wall Street, which I suppose by that terminology is a tacit admission that Wall Street lives in something of an unreal sector. The flow of funds numbers are immensely detailed, but let me just make a few headline remarks. The immense increase in financial assets over the last few decades looks like it's crested and is now going into reverse. We'll see how long this lasts, but the decline in financial instruments of all kinds over the last year or two has been striking. They've got a long way to go before they get back even to 2002 levels, but still, it's been nothing but up for the last 30 years, so this kind of reversal is really quite a shocker. One reason for this, households are giving up on borrowing, some voluntarily, some not. Consumer credit, credit cards, auto loans, and the like, and mortgage debt are both declining relative to household incomes. This has happened in the past, but never with the strength we've seen recently. The deleveraging, as they say on Wall Street, has been accompanied by a very weak economy. I think that what this tells us is that without the stimulus of rampant borrowing, the U.S. economy doesn't have much juice on its own. It's got to come up with a new model, or it's going to have a hard time getting off the mat. But, and this is a very important but, corporate America is doing very, very well. Corporate profitability, that is corporate profits, divided by the value of a corporate capital stock, meaning buildings and machines, in the second quarter surpassed a 2006 high and is within hailing distance of the late 1990s peak, which was the best in three decades. In striking contrast, at both previous peaks in profitability, the unemployment rate was about half current levels. But corporations are not investing their good fortune. Free cash flow, that is profits after taxes less capital expenditures, is just off a record high when measured against GDP, and the underlying trend is at an all-time high by a comfortable margin. And is they're accumulating lots of money but not spending it hiring people or investing in things. With so much uninvested cash flow, corporations are accumulating huge quantities of financial assets. These now surpass the value of their tangible assets, a situation with no modern historical precedent. That is, corporations, who are supposed to be in the business of making things and providing real services, are now accumulating more assets in the form of money than they are in the form of buildings and machines. If corporations were ever to plow some of those savings into investment and hiring, we could get a nice expansion going. But that's a very big if. For now, they're just hoarding their cash or taking each other over or stuffing their shareholders' pockets with Benjamins. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Marty Peretz. And that's some of the song Bad Vibrations from the band Black Angels, their new album Phosphine Dream. And that's a very fine band from Austin, Texas. I learned about by listening to the excellent and lovely Delphine Blue. Martin Peretz, as I said at the top of the show, bought the New Republic magazine back in the late 1970s using his wife's inherited money and moved it considerably to the right, and turning it in particular into a mouthpiece for a very rabid form of Zionism. Peretz attracted a lot of attention a couple of weeks ago when he wrote on his blog, the New Republic's website, these words: "But frankly, Muslim life is cheap, most notably to Muslims. And among those Muslims led by the Imam Rauf," that is the man who's convening leading the development of the misnamed Ground Zero Mosque, "there's hardly one who has raised a fuss about the routine and random bloodshed that defines their brotherhood. So yes, I wonder whether I need honor these people and pretend that they are worthy of the privileges of the First Amendment, which I have in my gut the sense that they will abuse." This is only the latest in a series of noxious remarks that Martin Peretz has made. Earlier this year, he said, "I can't imagine any venture requiring trust with Arabs turning out especially well. That, you will say, is my prejudice, but some prejudices are built on real facts, and history generally proves me right. Go ahead, prove me wrong." And back in 2006, he said this on his blog, but it actually seems now to have disappeared from the New Republic's website: "Even the bare rudiments of civilization will not soon come back to the banks of the Tigris and Euphrates." These and other remarks, you'll hear some more quoted in what just about is about to follow, caused a ruckus when Harvard University decided to name a scholarship fund after Martin Peretz. And actually a bunch of students and some faculty members and alumni really kicked up a wonderful fuss. We'll hear more about this also. But now some excerpts from a panel discussion at which Martin Peretz's name came up. Gorelick is Jamie Gorelick, who served in the Clinton administration and is now defending BP in their litigation over the oil spill. And the last voice you'll hear, the second to last voice, is that of Michael Walzer of Dissent magazine, a good friend of Peretz's and also a rabid Zionist himself. And then the proceedings brought to a close by the current director of Harvard Social Studies program, Richard Tuck. So let's listen to some of this video nabbed off YouTube, put together by some Harvard students.
This is a little bit for Professor Walzer, really for Ms. Gorelick. I want to start with Professor Walzer's invocation to take theoretical imperialism seriously. And while I don't agree with his rubbishing of Foucault, I do think that it's a good thing to do. And I'd like to do this in the context of Marty Peretz. And I'm going to read a Marty Peretz quote, and I want us to think, what theory comes through here? "So many in the black population are afflicted by cultural deficiencies. I would guess that in the ghetto, a lot of mothers don't appreciate the importance of schooling. So what kind of theory comes through here? Now, do we have an account of biopolitics, perhaps? Differential access to resources and opportunities that perhaps makes education less than desirable for certain populations? Nope. It's just either stupid or racist, or both. So now I turn my question to you, Ms. Gorelick. A person who has that kind of model for the world, what kind of teaching can they really be doing? If they have that much hatred for an entire aspect of humanity, what exactly would they be teaching you? So I would finish my little diatribe by asking you to defend such a disgusting person and to also say that people like you allow him to have the power that he does.
A fantastic teacher. He was generous with his time. He encouraged debate. He encouraged us in our studies, and we honored him for that by creating a fund to help undergraduates continue their work. Most of us who've known Marty for a long time have disagreed with him on many of his opinions. Marty himself was not endorsement of any particular view. I will tell you that, as Richard Tuck said at the outset, when we heard of this convocation, we thought this would be a nice way to honor a teacher who's meant a lot to many of us.
Can I just respond to the previous questioner? I wonder if you have undertaken a survey of everything that every present member of the social studies faculty has said in postings, in footnotes, in lectures, to make sure that nothing they have said is offensive or hurtful or unmarried.
Oh, come on.
Because if you're not doing that, well, I think you better start doing it, because you're going to find a lot of things you don't like.
Pathetic.
One thing that we may have noticed is that Marty Hertz has a pseudo-apology for the latest bigoted thing that he said. He said that, you know, he took back his comment about Muslims not deserving First Amendment protection. Since we have three of his, you know, friends on the panel, can I get a commitment from you guys to ask you to apologize for 25 years of bigotry and hatred? Thank you.
I was very keen that Abdel Nasser speak, because he's someone whom I have had very good dealings with and whose views, substantive views on this matter, I respect. But I don't think that it's appropriate at the moment for us to pursue these issues any further.
Isn't that wonderful, that pompous, posh accent? We shouldn't pursue this any further. The voice of the person who said you should check everyone's footnotes for noxious remarks was that of Michael Walzer, who is a big wheel at Dissent magazine and has a lot to answer for himself, and a good friend of Martin Peretz's. And now, an interview recorded earlier with Robert Paul Wolfe, who was... At the event was the first director of the social studies program in Harvard 50 years ago. He will give some background to all this in the open answer to the first question. But he is a professor emeritus of philosophy and African American studies at the University of Massachusetts, Robert Paul Wolfe. So, Robert Paul Wolfe, you're up at your alma mater recently to honor Marty Peretz. Tell us what happened in your visit to Cambridge.
Well, the event was actually the celebration of the 50th anniversary of an undergraduate interdisciplinary program called Social Studies, which has now existed for 50 years. And as it happens, I was the first head tutor of that program 50 years ago. The day was a day-long celebration of the program, bringing back lots of former social studies instructors and students, with panel discussions in the morning and the afternoon, and an invited lecture by Amy Gutman, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, who was herself a social studies student, and a lunch for 200 people in the middle of the day. So many people showed up for the event, 400 or 450, that they could only squeeze 200 of them into the Adams House dining room. And originally, I was scheduled to make a few remarks as the first head tutor, and Marty Peretz was scheduled to be honored by the creation of undergraduate research fund in his name, $500,000 or $600,000 donated by his friends. And when I learned about that, I came very close to withdrawing from the event, and in fact, they finally canceled the celebration of Marty Peretz at the lunch, and I was later told by Adele Simmons, formerly the president of Hampshire College and the head of the MacArthur Foundation, that there was a dinner on Friday evening. This was all on Saturday, but that the previous evening there had been a dinner, which I wasn't invited to, at which Marty was honored. I knew Peretz in the late 50s and early 60s when I was an instructor at Harvard. And as I've said in public and on my blog, he was an egregious little wannabe then, and he hasn't improved any in 50 years.
What did he want to be then?
He wanted to be a suck-up. He wanted to play with the big boys. He wanted to be accepted by the people whom he thought of as opinion leaders and such. And that is, I gather, what eventually led him to be an advisor to Al Gore, a thought which I have to say kind of strikes terror in my heart. But at any rate, so the event was a very nice event celebrating 50 years of a really quite good program, and it got hijacked by this controversy surrounding Peretz. He was not supposed to be the focus of attention, and when they started organizing the thing, apparently 18 months ago, they had no idea that this would happen. But then these people came forward wanting to honor Peretz, who spent a very great number of years in some way or another associated with the program and was, in fact, a head tutor of it for a while. And they, I'm told, anguished over what to do and finally decided to accept the money. surprise, surprise, I'm not aware that Harvard doesn't accept money. But at any rate, they decided to accept the money. And then a couple of weeks before the event, Peretz made these particularly outrageous remarks about 9/11 and Ground Zero and Muslims in the Muslim world, life is cheap, and he didn't know whether the Muslims had earned the right to of the protections of the First Amendment and so forth, and everyone went bananas over that, and they were stuck with him.
Of course, he's entirely consistent with a long career of noxious remarks, aren't they?
Well, he has an extraordinary career of noxious remarks. I haven't paid any attention to Marty in the last 50 years, and there was a protest by students, and the students did something which was quite wonderful, and which I have to say, as an old guy, impressed me enormously, just the technology of it. They dug up from the web lots and lots of Peretz's ugliest statements. They then produced beautiful printed signs, each one of which contained one of his ugly statements, and the students stood outside of the event, outside of the Science Center where the panels were and outside of Adam's house where the lunch was, holding these great big signs and chanting slogans. I mean, in my day, you ran stuff off on a mimeograph machine and handed it out. But and not only that, but the next day, there was a marvelously produced video on YouTube. I mean, it was all quite high-tech. In the lunch, when I got up to speak, I made a speech, and at the end, I'd originally planned just to talk about the old days of social studies and what it was like in the first year and to tell some funny stories and say some more serious things, but then this blew up, and so I added, at the end of my remarks, I added a carefully crafted and very strong statement about Peretz and the scholarship fund, and after I spoke, they introduced in turn each of the former head tutors who happened to be there. There have been 10 in all, and 7 of the 10 were there, and each of them was introduced, and Peretz, who was sitting at the table behind me, was introduced, and at that point, some people walked out of the lunch and then walked back in after they were finished recognizing him. And Peretz mumbled something about how the attacks on him had been cowardly. And since I had attacked him in his presence, it wasn't clear to me what he meant by saying that the attack was cowardly, but then I've never understood what Marty Peretz was talking about.
But he's actually used that program in his position at Harvard to cultivate a whole lot of followers. I mean, his former students are quite loyal to them, aren't they?
They're quite loyal to him. And as I said on my blog, I said, you know, here was the largest collection of sophisticated social theorists since the Frankfurt School held its last garden party, and in an entire day, the most that they could say about a controversy that was swirling around them was, well, Marty was a nice guy, and which didn't strike me as very deep analysis of what was happening. And when I was interviewed at the end of the day by a Harvard Crimson reporter, I said, look, you know, what this is all about is Israel, and nobody's willing to say that, but that's what it's all about. Well, all hell broke loose on my own blog with people writing all sorts of comments and so forth, because this is the third rail in American left-wing discussions. You're not allowed to say the word Israel except in a celebratory fashion. And it was transparently obvious. I mean, everybody knows that Peretz's ugliness is a direct consequence of the fact that he is more faithful to Israel than the Likud is. And everybody knows that the story of left-wing politics in the United States in the last 50 years has been the transformation of people who started out as socialists and radicals turning into neocons over the Israeli issue. And yet nobody was allowed to say those words.
Now, watching all this, I was wondering whether the silence of all these esteemed personages in the presence of Peretz was a result of just they're not wanting to offend a man they thought of, had personal affection for, thought of as a friend, or does he actually say things publicly that they think privately but lack the courage to say?
No, I don't think that's true of a lot of them. I think that they're appalled by the things he says. And in fact, some people, without mentioning his name, in effect said as much. But for one thing, Well, now, this is a kind of parochial view of what was going on, but I thought a lot about it afterward and tried to sort out in my own mind what was going on. These were, in certain circles, very important people. I mean, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, the former head of the MacArthur Foundation, Jamie Gerlich was one of the panelists who was in the Clinton Justice Department and sits now, I gather, on the BP board. I don't know. I mean, these are all, and they're academically important people. They are people who are accustomed to being accorded great respect whenever they show up any place, and who accord correspondingly a kind of senatorial respect to whoever else shows up. And there was a quality about that which is typical of Harvard, a quality of, you know, sort of medieval dukes meeting one another and bowing to one another and then proceeding on, followed by their train of supporters. I always think of them when they meet each other in Harvard Yard, sort of preceded by a quarter of a mile by their vitae like Cyrano's nose, and followed by a little cloud of deferential assistant professors. And they are not accustomed to just plain speaking the truth, even if it means they won't get invited to the next Aspen conference. And I realized afterward that it was more important to me to be faithful to the students standing outside chanting than it was to get invited back. And I'm sure I won't get invited back until maybe another 50 years has gone by.
A lot of those students, I must say I was very moved and inspired by them, that this is the better side of Harvard we're seeing there, isn't it?
Yeah, well, now, you see, this is the thing. For 50 years, social studies has been sort of what passes for the left at Harvard, and a lot of these kids are really wonderful kids. And I mean, some of them aren't kids anymore. I ran into a student who was my sophomore student 50 years ago, and the way things go, he's now 69 years old, and he's had a whole career. But there were some wonderful people there, and they are wonderful people, and what's more, a lot of wonderful people have taught in the program. But the program isn't a department. It doesn't give tenure. It chews up very good junior people who give several years of their lives teaching and then are booted out to find a career somewhere else. And Harvard, I think, is not very fond of social studies. It sticks social studies off campus up in Hillis House, which is half a mile or a mile away. Doesn't give them much money. I mean, doesn't give them much money by Harvard standards. By my standards from a state university, they're very lavishly funded, but by Harvard standards, they're underfunded. But they have been the place where progressive students tended to cluster when they were looking for a major. And it's now the third largest or fourth largest major at Harvard, so that, you know, there's a very good group of students who have come through this program for 50 years. And I will take them at their word if they say that they liked Marty. I can understand that, but they're not lying. They mean that they really liked Marty. I have some serious questions about whether you can learn social theory from somebody like Peretz. That's another pedagogical question, which is, you know, I've tried to write about on various occasions. But they did like him for whatever reason. I think they excused his obscene statements and his egregious behavior because they say that they found him a good teacher. I don't understand that, but I will accept it because that's what they say.
I'm speaking with Robert Paul Wolf, who's a professor emeritus of philosophy and African American studies at the University of Massachusetts. And let's talk a bit about Harvard and its role in our society. I went to Yale. I really quite enjoyed my time there. And I think going to a place like Yale or Harvard fills one with a degree of confidence bordering on arrogance that carries one through the rest of one's life. But, you know, what role does it play in this society? You left the Ivy League and spent most of your career at a state university. Tell us about the differences.
Well, quite dramatic difference. I had a funny career. I went to Harvard as a 16-year-old freshman. I got my bachelor degree there and my PhD, and I taught there for 3 years. Then I taught at the University of Chicago. Then I was a senior professor at Columbia. And after the 68 uprising at Columbia, where you remember they seized the administration building and brought the university to a halt for 2 weeks, I became increasingly disenchanted with the privileged, rather self-referential, narcissistic, and rather smug world of the Ivy League, not just Harvard, but Yale and Columbia and Princeton and so forth, in their different ways. And so I chose to leave a tenured professorship at Columbia and move to the University of Massachusetts, which was a big, sloppy, second-tier, underfunded state university in the process of expanding. And it was the most extraordinarily good decision I made in my entire career, because although UMass had no beautiful buildings designed by famous architects, and they never had enough money, and over the 37 years I was there, I guess there must have been about 6 budgetary crises when everything threatened to fall apart. It was a vibrant, exciting, progressive campus. We had the best Marxist economics department in the country. We had an exciting women's studies program. We had the best Afro-American studies department in the country, and scattered all over the campus in unlikely places like the German department or wherever were people who were not only good scholars, but who were serious, committed, progressive intellectuals. I started, when I got to UMass, I started an undergraduate interdisciplinary program, which I called Social Thought and Political Economy, which I thought of at the time as, quite consciously, as a left-wing version of social studies. Now, STEPIC, as it got called, sounds like an additive, a fuel additive in a racing car, but STEPIC, in every conceivable, measurable way, is inferior to social studies. The students are not as strong, the instructors are not as academically distinguished, the demands made upon the students in the program are less rigorous than those made in the social studies program, and yet I think it was a better program. And I, as I tried to explain to somebody, if something like this had happened at UMass, where, needless to say, they've got no money at all, so if somebody came along and offered them $650,000, they'd go bananas. But if somebody came along and offered $650,000 to honor somebody who's the equivalent of Marty Peretz, the program I started would have refused the money. And if the development office had said, you have to take it, not only would the students have protested, but the woman who now runs the program would have been leading them on a march to the administration building. And that says everything about the difference between the two. Now, as I explained to this person, I'm not an organic intellectual in the way that Gramsci meant. That is to say, I'm not somebody who works in a labor union or whatever. But I'm not an Ivy League intellectual either, and I would rather be at a school where when something like this happens, the students and the faculty together stand up and say, no way, than at a place where the faculty hems and haws and takes the money and the students are left standing outside holding signs.
So did your visit to Harvard really crystallize all these thoughts?
It did. I mean, I've thought them for a long time, but I hadn't really thought about social studies for a long time. I'd been doing a whole lot of other things. And the trip back, which originally, you know, initially I was quite delighted. I thought, God, here's a program I started half a century ago. If you live long enough, you get to see the programs you start live for half a century. This is very exciting. And it was fun. I saw some people I know, and I was, for about half a day, I was very impressed by being treated like somebody by other people who are somebodies, and then I began to get a queasy feeling in my stomach because I realized that these somebodies were not prepared just to stand up and say, hey, this is wrong, don't do it. And so I walked away thinking that for all its money and for all its academic distinction, Harvard is not a place that I would want to spend my time.
In a just society, would there be a role for a place like Harvard?
Well, in a just society, there would be certainly a place for a collection of outstanding intellectuals and researchers and academics, and a place, maybe, although this is more arguable, a place where the most talented students could be taught by them. But there isn't the slightest reason why such a place has to be awash in money. You could just as well run an operation like that with very little money, and in certain ways we did at UMass.
And that was the voice of Robert Paul Wolfe, a professor emeritus of philosophy and African-American studies at the University of Massachusetts, and he was deeply involved in the festivities surrounding Martin Peretz at Harvard. just a few days ago. Okay, let's take a break for station ID. We'll be back to talk about oil.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And this is WBAI, where we're certainly not enriching anybody, last of all, ourselves. So if you visit our website, WBAI.org, please hit the donate button. We can use all the help we can get. Okay, a musical break, and we'll be back to talk oil. And that's some of the song Gypsum Oil Field Fire by Olivia Tremor Control. And got the TV on here in the studio. I'm just seeing that they're forecasting 50 and 60 mile an hour gusts tonight. A couple of weeks ago I was here and there's a tornado in Brooklyn of all things. And now not quite tornado, but 50 or 60 mile an hour gusts. It's hard to escape the feeling that we're facing climate apocalypse, which is a good setup for Antonia Uhas, who is now joining us. She directs the oil program at Global Exchange. Welcome, Antonia.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
And I'm pronouncing your name correctly?
It's Uhas.
Uhas. Okay, now I got it. All right, Antonia Uhas. All right, well, you got Chevron Oil Company very mad at you at their annual meeting. What happened?
Well, let's see. I'm not the only one who incurred Chevron's wrath. I was part of a network that I helped organize of several dozen people from Chevron-affected communities from all around the world, all across the country, who came, some with proxies, some owning shares like myself, to attend Chevron shareholders' meeting to address the board and the executives and the shareholders and to let them know what it's really like to live in a community where Chevron operates. And we knew it was important to them because during the shareholder meeting, they actually showed a video about 2 minutes long of communities where they operate. What they wouldn't do is let the people from those communities in the meeting, and they denied access to people who had traveled all the way. There is a native Aborigines from Australia who had never left his country, and this was the first time he had done so that he could attend this meeting. A native Alaskan who had traveled 3 days from his community where he first had to kill a bear with his hands to feed his community so that he could be gone for 3 days to talk about Chevron where he lives. People from Colombia, Angola, Ecuador, myself from California, very much a Chevron-affected state and community. And everyone but a small handful of us were denied access inside, and those of us who were inside just talked about, you know, what it's like to be affected directly by this oil company. And while I can't get into the details, Chevron wasn't too happy with us telling the truth about their operations. And I got summarily removed and thrown into jail for 24 hours. And now Chevron is trying to send me to jail for another 6 months and four other people who got arrested out front of the meeting as well are being treated in the same fashion.
Now, there was a Wall Street Journal story about this the other day, and they say in the story that you are being charged with criminal trespass in disrupting a meeting or procession.
Yeah, you got to love that there's a charge for disrupting a meeting or a procession. That's
really,
one to jail in Texas. But
that's really
yeah,
beautiful.
Texas.
But also, the spokesperson for Chevron, Morgan Crinklaw, you can't make these names up, said that your actions clearly show that you are not interested in what the company has to say, only making a disturbance. I mean, that's a very interesting one-way form of communication. The shareholders meeting, apparently in his mind, is just a way for the company to talk to the world and not the company to hear from the world.
That's right, and I think that was upsetting to shareholders. Actually, if you look at the story appeared, I'm losing track of time, I think it was the day before yesterday, and it was first published on MarketWatch, which is the online news source for Bloomberg News. And that was a much longer piece, and that then got edited for the Wall Street Journal and shortened. On the MarketWatch site, there were hundreds of comments, just hundreds of comments, and many of them were shareholders just furious at the company for treating a shareholder this way. You know, the entire point of public companies required once a year to give its shareholders direct access to its executives, its board, to ask questions, to get the truth about a company. Because, of course, if the financial service industry has told us anything, there's a lot of secrets in these companies, and they hide secrets from their shareholders. And, you know, we were there to – I literally wrote a report 2 years in a row called The True Cost of Chevron, which is an alternative annual report for the company. And I was presenting the report, and shareholders there were interested in it, and believe me, shareholders online were interested in it. So I think this is most definitely going to backfire at minimum as an overreaction by Chevron, but at maximum as just a company, you know, absolutely refusing to take criticism and look at its own actions and do anything about them, most importantly.
Now, it's very unusual, of course, that they should press criminal charges, so I suspect this is not going to go anywhere. But you've got a campaign against Chevron specifically, right?
I direct a program that began about a year ago as the Chevron Program at Global Exchange, which is a human rights organization in San Francisco. And we are developing a model of organizing around the oil industry that involves linking those communities directly affected by the harms of the one company together, so that instead of having teeny communities going up against this corporation, which is the fifth largest corporation in the world, Chevron, just the fifth largest company in the world, its revenues were so big last year that only 36 countries had GDPs that were larger than its revenues. Instead of tiny communities individually trying to go head-to-head against this company, we create a network of those communities. And that network has been extremely successful, and we're now applying that model more broadly. And my program is now the Energy Program to take that a broader view into being, and also to demonstrate our particular focus that's emerged since the BP Gulf Oil disaster, you know, addressing Chevron and its offshore operations, but all of the industry's offshore operations in particular.
Chevron is the second largest oil company in the world?
Second in the United States.
Second in the U.S.
The fourth largest oil company in the world.
Give us an idea of the breadth of their wrongdoing.
Well, you know, let's see. I've written not only the two alternative annual reports for Chevron, but an entire book called "The Tyranny of Oil," which goes a lot into Chevron as well as other companies. But you know, there's just so many examples, and probably the most well known is Chevron's long history of abuse in Ecuador, a country right now, of course, where there is a coup against the president, Correa. I would not be surprised if one of the reasons why this coup is taking place at this moment is because the court in Ecuador seems poised to rule on a $100 billion judgment against Chevron for its environmental abuse in that country. And there has been a very long fight, a decade-long fight against that series of court cases, with Chevron pulling every dirty trick in its hat to try and win. And let's just say I wouldn't put it past those who want to see this case go away to at least have a hand in this sort of action.
Well, also, I wouldn't surprise, you know, the Ecuadorian elite certainly wants to keep on the good side of Chevron, too, so they could work hand in hand.
Exactly, exactly.
So what exactly are the dimensions of the damage that Chevron has done in Ecuador?
It's the largest environmental spill on land in world history. It's from decades of intentionally poor operations by Texaco, which Chevron purchased, and then Chevron's unwillingness to clean it up. And that oil has sat and become toxic and filled waterways, forests, land, the places where people live, where they eat, where they fish. It has caused cancers, deaths, ongoing suffering by a community that has to live in tar pits and oil waste. And that was left behind by Texaco, in which Chevron has refused to clean up and refused to pay for the damages. And thus there's a court case against them in Ecuador that appears to be headed towards judgment against them. And you know, they've done everything they can to try and say that Ecuador isn't an appropriate place to have this hearing, even though they're the ones who sent it down to Ecuador in the first place from New York. And that they claim they can't get a fair trial in Ecuador because they're losing.
That's a fair trial is when they win. We all, of course, well, not all, but certainly you and I, and I best most of the listeners would love to get beyond oil. But certainly, while we're living in the oil age, we could do things a little more cleanly than they've been doing it in Ecuador, can't we?
Sure. Yes, most certainly. You know, they were intentionally utilizing practices in Ecuador that they weren't even using here but were using there because they could. You know, basically, if you look all over the world, we have the wealthiest industry in the world. The oil industry is the wealthiest industry in the world, wealthier than any industry we've ever known. And all over the world, including in the United States, they cut corners. They use cheap tactics and operations, and devastation follows in its wake, and the Gulf oil disaster is the perfect example of that. Anyone following the hearings will see, and any of the investigations and reports, it's very, very, very clear that not just BP, but Transocean and the many companies involved were permitted to operate in poor operating conditions, cut corners, cut costs, and they were not being regulated, and the result of a lack of regulation and a willingness to let the industry do what it wanted to and essentially self-regulate itself, which amounted to no regulation, was unfortunately a very predictable, incredibly devastating outcome. And in smaller scale, those outcomes take place all over the world. In Angola, Chevron operates offshore facilities that have essentially killed off the local fishing population, through constant spills and pollution. The same is true in Nigeria. The same is true in Alaska. These offshore operations are constantly having incidents and accidents and spills and poor environmental upkeep. And the big result is the big blowout that we saw in the Gulf of Mexico.
You know, this is an incredibly lucrative industry, but almost everywhere it operates, it leaves behind nothing but poverty and toxic waste, right?
Most certainly. I don't think there's any community the one thing that people say who live in communities where oil companies operate is they are dependent on the resource, and that's what has happened in the Gulf of Mexico, and have become dependent on the companies. And it is what's called the resource curse. Countries and communities that are dependent on the production of oil, while it is simultaneously killing them environmentally, politically, and human health impacts. But because the industry has driven the development process, it's the only industry that's left. And you see economies that are dependent on oil also becoming the poorest economies, the most unhealthy of communities, and incredibly limited in their alternatives where they could have more choices. So, for example, this issue of the oil killing the fish, which is constant in areas where there's offshore drilling, and we're seeing it very clearly in the Gulf. The oil kills the fish. You know you don't like the oil because it's killing the fish, but once the fish are gone, what else are you going to do but go after the oil? And that's also what we're seeing taking place in the Gulf.
And it also seems that they create a social structure in most of the countries that produce oil that is a thin layer of an oligarchy, very rich and very corrupt and very powerful, and manages to deflect any attempts to clean things up or spread the wealth more equally.
Well, that's right. Politically, you also get caught in this curse, which is that there is less wealth to go around, and the wealth gets held in a small pool of elites who are willing to support the industry. The industry remains dominant because no other industry can challenge it, because there isn't any room for other industry to grow. It dominates the politics. It dominates who are the leaders. It dominates the elite. And the elites do well while the rest of the country and the economy or the community, again, this all applies to the Gulf Coast as well, gets run into the ground.
I'm speaking with Antonio Yuhas, who directs the Global Exchange Oil Program and is being prosecuted by the state of Texas on behalf of Chevron because she disrupted an annual meeting by trying to tell them what they were doing.
Chevron says that I disrupted
yes.
a meeting because I presented as a shareholder an alternative annual report for Chevron. I certainly don't say that the state of Texas says, or rather Chevron says, that I disrupted their meeting.
Well, it's trying to get a break from business as usual. Now let's talk about the Gulf a bit. We were chatting on email the other day, and you pointed out that you were it was amazing that Congress has done absolutely nothing. It's adjourning, having done absolutely nothing about offshore drilling. I suppose this shouldn't be too surprising, but it is shocking and depressing nonetheless.
Yeah, so I am writing a book on the Gulf oil disaster and have spent the last 4 months back and forth between the Gulf and a stint in D.C. And for listeners who don't know, today and last night, depending on if you're talking about the House or the Senate, the Congress adjourned. They adjourned 10 days ahead of schedule. It's the earliest adjournment since 1960 that the Congress has taken to go electioneering for the midterm elections. And they adjourned 10 days early, having not passed a single piece of legislation, not one, in response to the Gulf oil disaster. And there were many, many, many to choose from. Bills that banned offshore drilling altogether, bills that were very straightforward and had been lobbied for by the families of the 11 people who died on the rig. One very simple piece of legislation would have simply made it possible for those families to get meaningful compensation on behalf of their loved ones who were killed. They are utterly heartbroken and distraught that that legislation could not be passed. In June, much of this legislation sailed through the House while the spill was spewing, while the gusher was spewing. When the gusher stopped spewing, the political attention stopped as well, and the oil industry was really able to take advantage of what is going to go down in history, I think, as one of the most successful lobbying campaigns in the oil industry's part, and one of the most expensive, to convince lawmakers not to pass legislation and to convince the American public that this is an isolated incident.
How did they do it?
Applies to BP. Well, they spent a tremendous amount of money lobbying. The money's been split between lobbyists and supporting the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and its spending on the November elections, which are significantly higher than what they spent in 2008, a whopping $75 million on just for the Chamber of Commerce, just on these midterms. And that is thanks to the Citizens United ruling that lifts the spending limit on what companies can spend. And so it's two-pronged to say that elected officials will not get reelected in the midterms if they vote against the industry, to do that in the election process, to do it in the lobbying process, to say we're the ones who are watching you, we're the ones who are paying attention, and then through a very aggressive, coordinated media and public strategy, which was the rest of the industry rallying together to say we're safe, it's BP that's not, isolating BP, putting them in a corner, which is not normal for the way that the industry responds to these sorts of incidents.
And I notice now that Shell is trying to take over as a sensitive oil company, that BP has been discredited.
But one of the things that's also happening is the Macondo well, which is what BP was drilling when the Deepwater Horizon exploded, that particular hole has been sealed, but it's been clear that the rest of the reservoir is going to remain open to drilling. So it looks like the other companies are going to get to take advantage of BP's loss and start pumping oil from the Macondo well again.
Now, there was a moratorium on offshore drilling for a while, wasn't there?
There is, in the Gulf of Mexico, a moratorium on deep offshore drilling that the Obama administration has put in place, which remains in place. The deadline was to be November 30th to consider whether it should be lifted or not. Now it seems very clear that the administration is succumbing to pressure and is likely to lift that moratorium and to lift it even before the investigations are complete. So the most important investigation that's ongoing is that by the Deepwater Horizon Commission, that is Investigation Commission, which is the U.S. Coast Guard and the Interior Department, which has had an excellent series of hearings, excellent investigations that are ongoing. And what they seem to very, very clearly be leading to as a resolution is that the industry has gone past its own technological know-how. It is being utterly unregulated by the federal government. It is failing at its own self-regulation, and it is not at all surprising that this incident occurred and that it is not a situation that is isolated to BP and its practices.
But now it looks like the attitude of Congress administration is, yeah, but carry on, boys, right?
So they adjourned without passing any legislation, and the same day that they adjourned today, the Interior Department Secretary Ken Salazar announced new regulations that the Interior Department is implementing on the industry. And these are welcome. Certainly they are some good changes, but they are the least, essentially, that the industry could do. And it seems to me that it's the trade that's happened is that the industry has accepted these new regulations and that the moratorium is going to be lifted early. And that seems to be a trade-off that's happened. And the more stringent regulations that could have been imposed by the legislation that was being offered died, and in exchange, the industry essentially accepted these new regulations by the Interior Department. The problem is that one of the pieces of legislation that has died is an appropriation for about $100 million that the Interior Department asked for to actually implement these new regulations. So the staff that they need, the training they need, the oversight they need. So far, we may face a situation where they do, in fact, have some good new regulations, but don't have the capacity to implement it because they don't have the cash or the staff to make it happen.
And we're almost out of time because we have to get out of here a little early, but this is all happening before we even really know just how much damage was done in the Gulf.
Oh, we're nowhere near knowing. Depending on who is doing the science, there's 50 to 80% of the oil is still out there. It is impacting the entire biological chain from the tiniest microbes to it now looks like we're seeing impacts on sharks and whales and, of course, human health impacts. And we're, again, only beginning, one, to understand the impacts, but the impacts themselves have only just begun because this oil is still out there and most disturbingly could at any time be renewed back to shore with hurricanes and severe weather, which, as you started the program saying, are, of course, increasingly intense.
All right. Well, thank you, Antonia Yuhas, and good luck with all your work because it's really important. I've been speaking with Antonia Yuhas, who directs the oil program at Global Exchange in San Francisco. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. And let's go out with this from Vampire Weekend, I Think You're a Contra. Bye.
That you and I could tell each other everything for 2 months. But even with our oath, with truth on our side, when you turn away from it's not right. I think you're